Okay, so we've been studying Moses, trying to study the life of the man Moses and try to get a feel for the man Moses. So we're not going to be necessarily going into all the details of everything that happened in the book of Exodus. But we'll try to get to some of the highlights so we understand what's going on when Moses reacts the way he does. So, Moses, we have covered his early life. He was raised in the palace, apparently, of the king of Egypt. So he was in a place of great power and prestige and probably was in a leadership role. We don't have any biblical record of that, but it seems likely that that was the situation. Then, at about age 40, he decided that he was going to be part of his people, the children of Israel. He was going to be a Hebrew and putting up with what the Hebrews put up with. We noted that he killed an Egyptian who was mistreating a Hebrew. Then that word got out and got to Pharaoh. And he fled. He went to the land of Midian. He lived there again for the next 40 years. Married, had two children. We'll see a little bit more of that probably later on today. And then God spoke to him from the burning bush, told him to return to Egypt, that those who were seeking his life were dead, and that he was to go back there and to lead the children of Israel out of there into the land that God had promised to give to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So at the point we are right now, we have reached the point where Moses and Aaron are to go before Pharaoh and try to convince him to let the children of Israel go out into the wilderness for 3 days, or a 3 days journey into the wilderness at least, and there to worship the Hebrew God. And we see Pharaoh's reaction to that, although God had predicted exactly what that reaction would be. So that's the point we are at this point in time. So before we actually begin the class this morning, Mike, could you lead us in a word of prayer? Mike Franklin? Okay. So we're here in Exodus chapter 7. It says, "Now the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, 'When Pharaoh speaks to you, saying, "Work a miracle," then you shall say to Aaron, "Take your staff and throw it down before Pharaoh, that it may become a serpent." So Moses and Aaron came to Pharaoh, and thus they did, thus just as the Lord had commanded. And Aaron threw his staff down before Pharaoh and his servants, and it became a serpent. Then Pharaoh called all the wise men and the sorcerers, and they also, the magicians of Egypt, did the same with their secret arts. For each one threw down his staff, and they turned into serpents. But Aaron's staff swallowed up their staffs. Yet Pharaoh's heart was hardened, and he did not listen to them as the Lord had said." So God has already told Moses, whatever you tell Pharaoh, he's not going to listen. I'm going to bring the people out after a series of miracles have happened that finally convince them that it's best to let us go, or let the children of Israel go. And so we're going to see those. I'm not going to go through each one of the plagues. I mean, we can see the plagues. They are interesting, but they don't really lead us to any greater knowledge of the man Moses himself. We could look at the plagues. They're listed here. The water was turned to blood. There's frogs all over the land. Was the plague of lice, the plague of flies, the Egyptian cattle dying, the plague of boils, the plague of hail, plague of locusts and darkness over all the land, and then the death of the firstborn. After each one of these, Pharaoh said, I'll let you do something. I'll let you do this, or I'll let you do that. I'll let the men go out into the wilderness, but the rest of the families have to stay behind. So Pharaoh was trying to keep the people from getting away, but he would make this pledge, and if he put limits on it, Moses would turn him down. If he didn't put limits on it, then he changed his mind before he let them actually go out of the land. So we see Pharaoh's heart here was, he was apparently a very arrogant individual, which if you think about the situations in those times, the Egyptian kings, the pharaohs, were considered, shall we say, minor gods. They were certainly objects to be revered and objects to be worshipped. So the pride and arrogance that goes with somebody in that kind of a position is probably not too surprising. And when you have someone who has absolute power, it's likely that they're going to have that kind of an attitude. If not in the first generation, by the time you get into the second or third, you're going to find that that kind of an attitude is very dominant and predominant, I think, in the kings that you have at that particular time. So Andrew wants to bring up the question of did Pharaoh have free will at this particular point in time? And as he mentioned that last week, so God said this is what's going to happen, and he said he would harden Pharaoh's heart. So did he have free will or not? Dan?
Plagues are kind of like a double-edged sword to God. You cannot be good that Pharaoh had the free will.
Okay, Mike?
Every human being has free will. If we were to argue that Pharaoh did not have free will, we would find an exception in which he would be without blame, because it would be something he couldn't help but do because he had no free will. But he bore responsibility for the choices he made. And if we look at Pharaoh and ask, did he have free will? We should look at Job and ask, did he have free will? When he suffered the trials that he did and the questions that he faced and largely remained faithful to God, he also had free will. So either potential is there, and if we do not allow for him to have, for Pharaoh to have free will, then what glory would it have been to God or benefit to Pharaoh if Pharaoh had made a choice to let the children of Israel go? It would have been, again, nothing that he had any control over.
Bill Downey and then Bill Spahn.
Nobody questions him.
Not even after that. Bill?
Yeah. One thing we know for sure is that God knew ahead of time, just like he knows about our lives. He knows ahead of time what we're going to do. Time to him isn't anything. He knows the future, right? And there's many passages that show God knows the future. And so whether Pharaoh hardened his heart or not was up to Pharaoh.
Amen.
And so if he had been a man, if he was a different man, then the plagues that God brought on him would have softened his heart. And we would say then that Pharaoh softened his heart, and God softened Pharaoh's heart, right? Because he was the agent was the agent when the trials came in this particular situation. Because of the kind of person Pharaoh was, he hardened his heart. Or if it would have been a different man, he might have softened his heart. So, in the case, God knew what was going to happen and used it for his purpose. It's like everything we read in the story of Joseph. He knew all that was going to happen there and set it up so that Joseph would be a deliverer of his people. So, I agree with both Dan and everybody else who said that he didn't humble his heart, and it was his free choice not to do that.
Andrew?
So the only time in that place, or when it's Cyrus in that place, you know, he puts in power who he wants in power, right? But it was God's intention to judge.
But God was influencing him to make this these choices, I think. Because that's clearly what it states, that God said, I will harden his heart. And so God was going to influence this man to do this way. Although I think that the tools that God had to use there was basically the arrogance that was part of Pharaoh that would cause him to be able to do that very readily. Dan, you had a comment? Yeah. Mike, you had a comment again? No? Okay, Bill?
I think this applies to every person in the Bible, as well as every person who ever lived. It applied to Judas. Judas had his own, he could have chosen not to do the things he did. And yet we know that this all happened, as the Bible says, by the foreknowledge and predetermination of God, that somebody would be there to betray. One of the things we should glory in God, because he, unlike us, knows everything, and we can't imagine how he does it, but he knows it before it happens. You know, and so in that way he doesn't go against our free will, but realizes these are the people that are going to be playing part of the picture of and all this back in the time of Pharaoh and Moses and up until the time of Judas, all bringing salvation to man through Jesus Christ. Things were going to happen in a certain way, and certain people will be there to fulfill it.
Okay. Mike?
I understand the question, and I also don't get why people get so hung up on this. You see examples of people who harden their hearts and choose not to do what God has told them to do. You also see examples of people who are seemingly pretty set in their ways, like a fellow that I knew that said to his father-in-law, I'm going to study and I'm going to prove to you that baptism is not necessary for salvation. And then 3 weeks later, he was calling me on the phone asking me if he could be baptized. So, you know, there's those individuals who have their hearts set and then they let the Word of God or they let God's message to them soften their heart and they turn and they do what's right. So it's the same process. It's just one goes one way and the other one goes the other way.
Okay. Lorenzo?
God made Moses like a god.
Says he did that.
Yeah. I lost my thought. I'm sorry.
Okay. Yeah. Because God did say that he would make... yes?
Basically, in God being hardening Pharaoh's believing he's all-powerful, and God's showing he's not.
Okay.
Just by doing that, it's going to put his back up because he's going to fight back.
Yes?
You're playing off.
Okay.
And
Andrew, you talk, you want to?
Well, I did to use related stuff to Egyptian God.
I've seen the same thing. So if we were really going to study the plagues, we would go through and pick out each one of those.
Yeah. Not only was Pharaoh powerless to fight these, so were the Egyptian gods.
So were the Egyptian gods. He was attacking with each one of these plagues one of the Egyptian gods. So that it became apparent to them, at least at the end, that the God of the Hebrews was more powerful than the gods of Egypt. And that was certainly a message that he intended to send to the Egyptians. That while we look at these things and say, you know, the plague of boils, wow, that sounds painful. To them, it was even more than that because it was attacking one of their gods, and I didn't take the time to try to go through and and work that, because that wasn't the purpose of what I was trying to get to with this class. Mike?
And the other aspect of that is that these plagues affected the Egyptians and not the Israelites. And so there was that aspect of showing both Pharaoh and the Israelites that the gods of the Egyptians had no power over them. That they were not obligated to serve them in any way. At the same time as he was showing Pharaoh that the Egyptian gods were powerless to save him and his people.
Right.
So each one of these was not only a blow to Pharaoh's ego, it was a blow to the whole culture and system that put him in power.
Okay. So let's go on. Now here we're finding in Exodus 12 that this is after the death of the firstborn, the tenth plague. Verse 33 there says, "The Egyptians urged the people to send them out of the land in haste, for they said, 'We will all be dead.' So the people took their dough before it was leavened, with their kneading bowls bound up and their clothes on their shoulders. Now the sons of Israel had done according to the word of Moses, for they had requested from the Egyptians articles of silver and articles of gold and clothing. And the Lord had given the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, so they let them have their request. Thus they plundered the Egyptians." So here we see God again influencing people to give up things of value, at least, to loan them to these children of Israel. This was before the last plague. So they had these things in hand when the time came that the Egyptians said, not only you can go, but get out of this land and do it right now. They were terrified of what was going on, and justifiably so. These 10 plagues probably had convinced the Egyptian people themselves that they should get rid of these Hebrews before things got really worse. But it wasn't until this point in time that the people said, "Let them go, or get them out of here now." Don?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, that was repeated twice, right?
Right.
He said, "Hey, this is the hand of God. What are you doing, Pharaoh?" So evidently some of them were convinced, like, you know, not very far even these plagues.
Yeah, I think many of them probably were. We're going to see in a little bit another indication that probably many of the common people were convinced early on that this was probably not, this was the God of the Hebrews acting, and they probably better not try to interfere with it. "Now the sons of Israel journeyed from Ramses to Succoth, about 600,000 men on foot, aside from children. A mixed multitude, they went up with them along with flocks and herds and a very large number of livestock." So most estimates, people would estimate, time you figure that you've got 600,000 men and women and children beyond that there probably was close to 3 million people, maybe somewhere in that range of 2 to 3 million people in this group that was heading out of the land of Egypt. With livestock, they're not going to move very far very fast. It's going to take them a long time to get anywhere to move this many people. So recognize this isn't something where everybody jumped on their chariot and headed out at full speed, that these people were largely afoot. They were herding sheep, cattle, probably camels, mules, horses, donkeys, everything they had with them, and they were headed out of the land. "The baked dough which they had brought out of Egypt into cakes of unleavened bread, for it had not become leavened since they were driven out of Egypt and could not delay, nor had they prepared any provisions for themselves." So we see here the origination of the use of unleavened bread at the Passover. The Passover was to remind them of this death of the firstborn, this last plague, the plague that drove them out of Egypt. And so from this time on, at the Passover, they partook of unleavened bread. God put that into law later on. But at this point, we see that it happened just as a natural occurrence of what is going on. And we talked about this next couple of verses before. The time the sons of Israel lived in Egypt was 430 years. At the end of 430 years to the very day, all the hosts of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt. So we notice that there's two ways that this is interpreted. And the reading in the Septuagint, they have added a phrase in there that indicates this was from the time that that Abraham and his descendants dwelt in a land that was not theirs. So as long as Abraham and his descendants had sojourned in a land that didn't belong to them, they would count as part of these 430 years. Other commentators believe that the genealogy is abbreviated so that they've left out generations and that they were in the land of Egypt for 430 years. Don't know that it makes a great deal of difference to anybody. It shouldn't affect anybody's salvation. But these are the two interpretations that you see out there. And you can take either one of them that you want, and I don't think anybody can prove you wrong, at least any more than any one of us can prove we're right about what we choose to believe about this particular issue. Okay, the road of the Exodus, and I've got two maps here. This is the territory that they're covering. They're coming from somewhere up in this area. They're going down. This route on this map does not show them crossing the Red Sea anywhere. The next map here does bring them down. It brings them down this route. So they're crossing the very tip of the Gulf of Suez up here, at least according to the ideas that these map makers have. Nobody knows the exact route. Nobody knows the exact place where they crossed the Red Sea. There is a theory going around that's fairly common today that it really wasn't Gulf of Suez that they crossed, but the Gulf of Aqaba, clear over here someplace, and that Mount Sinai is somewhere over here on this side of the Gulf of Aqaba. But it says they arrived there in 3 months. Now, you're moving 2-3 million people with herds of cattle and livestock. Getting that far in 3 months probably would be a little bit of a stretch in my mind. But we don't know. And we don't know the exact route that they took, and we really can't pinpoint where Mount Sinai is. Jews, I'm sure, have a particular peak picked out over there that represents that. And I suspect that's right down in this area here. But beyond that, recognize that these kind of things are out there and that you've got people trying to to prove that it took place one place or the other. And I don't think we can prove anything anyway, and I don't really think that it matters that much. But that is the theories that are out there with regard to this. Now, The king of Egypt has had 10 chances to change his mind and let the children of Israel go, and until the 10th plague, he didn't do so. But in Exodus 14, when the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, Pharaoh and his servants had a change of heart toward the people. And they said, "What is this that we have done, that we have let Israel go from serving us?" So, man, we just let 3 million slaves get away from us. That's something that we probably shouldn't have done. And again, his willingness to ignore the power that had been shown to him in the plagues is interesting anyway. So he made his chariot ready and took his people with him. He took 600 select chariots and all the other chariots of Egypt with officers over all of them. The Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he chased after the sons of Israel as the sons of Israel were going out boldly. Then the Egyptians chased after them with all the horses and chariots of Pharaoh, his horsemen and his army, and they overtook them camping by the sea beside Pi-Hahiroth in front of Baal-Zephon. And don't hold me to those pronunciations. I don't have any better guess at what they should be than you do. So they overtook them camping by the sea. Now, how long it was before Pharaoh decided to chase after them, again, we have no knowledge, no information given to us with regard to that. As Pharaoh drew near, the sons of Israel looked, and behold, the Egyptians were marching after them, and they became very frightened. So the sons of Israel cried out to the Lord. Then they said to Moses, "Is it because there were no graves in Egypt that you have taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you dealt with us in this way, bringing us out of Egypt?" So here we've seen it. 10 very powerful plagues meted upon the Egyptians. And the children of Israel were glad to get up and take off when the chance was finally given to them. But now they're out here, they're in what looks like a bad spot. They've got an army that's probably as big as the Egyptian army, maybe even bigger. But they've got their wives and children with them too, as well as all their livestock that they've got to deal with. And so now they're complaining. Bill?
This back there, this is a lot more graphic and tremendous with all the plagues and seeing everything. But yeah, they've forgotten about who we are sometimes too. Often, you know, now this year we got a trial that we, you know, and we worry about it. And we get overwhelmed because we're thinking, God, those guys.
Yeah, people haven't changed much in the last few thousand years. So, is this not the word we spoke to you in Egypt, saying, "Leave us alone that we may serve the Egyptians"? For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness. So, all is lost. We're just going to have to give up. So, we think about that. Do miracles create a lasting faith in God? There's certain indications in the Bible that they do not. And here we have an example of that being happening. They will see many more miracles before they enter the land of Canaan. They will see many more miracles before they refuse to go into the land of Canaan. Yet they don't tend to place their faith in God. They'll take the miracle, but in the long run, it may give them encouragement at the moment, but it doesn't seem to keep them going. Lazarus, story of Lazarus and the rich man, where the rich man was told that he wanted someone to send back to his brothers to tell them to straighten up and not come to this place. That he said, if they won't listen, they won't hear Moses and the prophets, they won't hear someone who comes back from the dead. So miracles do not have a tendency to create faith in those that see them. They may be able to create faith in those that read about them years later. They should be able to help create faith in us. We look at the whole story of the 10 plagues and the children of Israel coming out of Egypt. We see a bigger picture, and that should tend to increase our faith, but it did not increase the faith of the individuals who were going through it, at least not on a long-term basis. So the Jews in Christ's time saw miracles after miracle after miracle, but many of them, some accepted it, believed in this man. Others did not. And we see that the two men on the road to Emmaus, after when Christ was talking to them after his resurrection, And they said, we had hoped that this was the Messiah. So they had given up what they that all that they had seen had previously convinced them, but now they see something that seems to contradict all that, and they just gave up. They were willing to come back quickly, but for a moment there, they were gone. Bill?
Miracles are a form of evidence for something, right?
Yep.
What you do with that, you proceed after that, or go on after that, is what your heart is about, whether you're going to really have confidence, whatever kind of evidence, miraculous or any of the other wonderful evidence that there, that we have to process ourselves in.
Okay. Now, one exception to this, there's that Moses did place his faith in God. Of course, Moses was intimately involved in all of this process. But we see throughout that he believes confidently that God will see to it that things work out for them. And that seems to be a very, very strong characteristic of Moses, is that no matter what, he trusts God. I mean, he can see this army coming after them too. He has reason to despair at that point in time. But he says, God said he was bringing us out. He's bringing us out. You can depend on that. But Moses said to the people, do not fear. Stand by and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you have seen today, you will never see them again forever. The Lord will fight for you while you keep silent. So Moses doesn't yet at this point in time, but these are two verses, know what God's going to do. But he's confident God's going to bring salvation at this point to these people. Then the Lord said to Moses, why are you crying out to me? Tell the sons of Israel to go forward. As for you, lift up your staff and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it. And the sons of Israel shall go through the midst of the sea on dry land. As for me, behold, I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians so that they will go in after them. And I will be honored through Pharaoh and all his army, through his chariots and his horsemen. Then the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord when I am honored through Pharaoh, through his chariots and his horsemen. And the angel of God who had been going before the camp of Israel moved and went behind them, and the pillar of cloud moved from before them and stood behind them. So it came between the camp of Egypt and the camp of Israel, and there was the cloud along with the darkness, yet it gave light at night. Thus the one did not come near the other all night. So God puts a barrier between the children of Israel and the Egyptians. And even the Egyptians aren't about to charge into this obviously miraculous cloud of some sort. While it's not a physical barrier, it's a cloud. How much resistance do you have when you try to walk through fog? You don't meet any appreciable resistance. But yet, here was this glowing cloud, and they weren't about to go through it. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord swept the sea back by a strong east wind all night and turned the sea into dry land. So the waters were divided. The sons of Israel went through the midst of the sea on the dry land, and the waters were like a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. Then the Egyptians took up the pursuit, and all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen went in after them into the midst of the sea. At the morning watch, the Lord looked down on the army of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire and cloud and brought the army of the Egyptians into confusion. He caused their chariot wheels to swerve, and he made them drive with difficulty. So the Egyptians said, let us flee from Israel, for the Lord is fighting for them against the Egyptians. So here we see many in the army have decided that this is a bad enterprise. We best give it up. They're willing to turn and go back. Apparently, at least most of them did not, but this was the point that was on them. Bill?
I mean, pillar of fire. You know, I mean, who's going to chase that? It's amazing they got as far as they did. Because, I mean, they realize these are all miraculous,
right,
natural things that God is doing, and yet, I guess maybe they didn't figure.
Okay. So, the children of Israel have crossed the Red Sea. They're now standing on the other side. Then the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand over the sea so that the waters may come back over the Egyptians, over their chariots and their horsemen. So Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the sea returned to its normal state at daybreak, while the Egyptians were fleeing right into it. Then the Lord overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea. The waters returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen, even Pharaoh's entire army that had gone into the sea after them. Not even one of them remained. But the sons of Israel walked on dry land through the midst of the sea, and the waters were like a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. Some people have interpreted this that he's parted the sea by a strong east wind. But a strong east wind would have dried out the land quickly, but the wall, it would not have created a wall of water on either side of them. Maybe on one side, but not both. So there was something more miraculous going on here than just a strong east wind.
Amen.
Thus the Lord saved Israel that day from the hand of the Egyptians. And Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. When Israel saw the great power which the Lord had used against the Egyptians, the people feared the Lord, and they believed in the Lord and his servant, Moses. And how long does this last? This is the point here that I think we need to think. I've got another map here. This again showing the route of the Exodus. So they're somewhere likely down in this region where this takes place. Like I say, the other option is down over here across the Gulf of Aqaba. And that seems like it's a long stretch to get this many people and herds of livestock in a short period of time. But somewhere down in here is where the people are at this point in time. So they said they go into the wilderness of Shur. Then Moses led Israel from the Red Sea, and they went out into the wilderness of Shur. And they went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. When they came to Marah, they could not drink the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. Therefore it was named Marah. So the people grumbled at Moses, saying, what shall we drink? Then he cried to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a tree, and he threw it into the waters, and the waters became sweet. There he made for them a statute and a regulation, and there he tested them, and he said, if you will give earnest heed to the voice of the Lord your God, and do what is right in his sight, and give ear to his commandments, and keep all his statutes, I will put none of the diseases on you which I have put on the Egyptians, for I, the Lord, am your healer. Then they came to Elim, where there were 12 springs of water and 70 date palms, and they camped there beside the waters. The region they're going into is quite arid. We're familiar with that today, and perhaps it is more arid today than it was then. In fact, there's some indications that that may be the case. But they're going to have to have a lot of water if you're going to feed and give to drink that many people and that much livestock. So God needs to have provided for them water in great abundance. And so the people were concerned about it. So the people are grumbling. We don't see them rebelling against God other than the fact that they're not trusting in God to give them what they need. They are grumbling and complaining at this time. And we're told in the New Testament that we're not to grumble and complain as they grumbled and complained, and were cut down in the wilderness because of it, that they didn't tend to put their confidence in God. Then they set out from Elim, and all the congregation of the sons of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after their departure from the land of Egypt. The whole congregation of the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. The sons of Israel said to them, "What would that we had died at by the Lord's hand in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the pots of meat, when we ate bread to the full, for you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." So 6 weeks now, they've been gone from the land of Egypt. And they're hungry. They're remembering what they had to eat back in the land of Egypt, and this just doesn't. You brought us out here to die, and now we're starting to see they're not putting any confidence in God that He will provide them something to eat. But this is the pattern that we see going through here. And the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day, that I may test them, whether or not they will walk in my instruction. On the sixth day, when they prepare what they bring in, it will be twice as much as they gather daily." So Moses and Aaron said to all the sons of Israel, "At evening you will know that the Lord has brought you out of the land of Egypt, and in the morning you will see the glory of the Lord. For He hears your grumbling against the Lord. And what are we that you grumble against us?" So Moses is beginning to feel the pressure here. People here are grumbling about him. And he says, you know, the Lord's the one that brought you out here. And He will see to it that you have what you need. But they're grumbling, and Moses is beginning to feel the pressure that they're being unfair to him, and indeed they are. Because if they look back at it, think about it, I mean, who was the one that provided the miracles that brought them out of the land of Egypt? It wasn't Moses doing it on his own power, that it was the power of God. And yet they have forgotten that. So they're complaining about the leadership that they've got to deal with today. So, okay, Mike?
Yeah, here's Christ himself, you know, in his instruction on how men should pray, of course, includes the phrase, "Give us this day our daily bread." And no doubt this was a reflection upon the idea that God had provided their daily bread back then, and did so without fail. And people forget that.
People forget that very quickly. Okay. Moses said, "This will happen when the Lord gives you meat to eat in the evening and bread to the full in the morning. For the Lord hears your grumbling, which you grumble against Him. And what are we? Your grumblings are not against us, but against the Lord." So even if you're grumbling, "Moses brought us out here so that we could die in this wilderness, and it's not me that did it, it's God that did it. And so you're not grumbling really against me, but you're grumbling against God Himself." Then Moses said to Aaron, "Say to all the congregation of the sons of Israel, come near before the Lord, for He has heard your grumbling." It came about as Aaron spoke to the whole congregation of the sons of Israel, that they looked toward the wilderness, and behold, the glory of the Lord appeared in the cloud. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "I have heard the grumblings of the sons of Israel. Speak to them, saying, at twilight you shall eat meat, and in the morning you shall be filled with bread, and you shall know that I am the Lord your God." So it came about at evening that the quails came up and covered the camp, and in the morning there was a layer of dew around the camp. Now, how many's ever thought about hunting quail? I mean, you go out and you spend a day out there wandering in the prairie land, perhaps, and maybe you see some and maybe you don't. And here, they don't even have to go out of the camp. The birds come to them, rather than them having to go to the birds. And I'm sure that those people had hunted quail. Or at least enough of them that it knows that this was not something that was normal. "And when the layer of dew evaporated, behold, on the surface of the wilderness there was a fine flake-like thing, fine as the frost on the ground. When the sons of Israel saw it, they said to one another, 'What is it?' For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, 'It is the bread which the Lord has given you to eat. This is what the Lord has commanded. Gather of it every man as much as he should eat, and you shall take an omer apiece according to the number of persons each of you has in his tent. So the sons of Israel did so, and some gathered much and some little. And when they measured it with an omer, he who had gathered much had no excess, and he who had gathered little had no lack. Every man gathered as much as he should eat. Moses said to them, let no man leave any of it until morning. But they did not listen to Moses. Some left part of it until morning, and it bred worms and became foul, and Moses was angry with them. They gathered it by morning by morning, every man as much as he should eat, but when the sun grew hot, it would melt. So like frost on the ground you see out there in the morning, you have this white stuff out there, you go out, you pick it up. An omer, I tried to figure out how much that was, and basically I can tell you that nobody knows exactly. It appears to be something between a half gallon and a gallon, somewhere in that range, give or take. It's not going to be close, but that's somewhere in the range of what it would be. Dan?
It's interesting. They come and follow him because they were aged. They ate. And he said, you didn't. And they come back with him this year. Moses gave us, didn't give you bread. God gave you bread.
That's true.
And I am the bread of life.
Okay. Yeah, our time has been up for about 3 minutes. I just now noticed that. So let's go ahead and break here.